now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult to propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
The old Cold Warriors may have been right about Russia after all. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Our guest today is author of a brand new book, taking a look at Russia and its role in the fulfillment of Bible prophecy, specifically Ezekiel 38, the Gog-Magog conflict. He's the author of a number of books. He's been a frequent guest here on A View from the Bunker. And, well, just to list some of the titles that we've discussed on this program, Power Quest Books 1 and 2, Lying Wonders of the Red Planet, Is Russia Destined to Nuke the U.S.? And the new book, The Next Great War in the Middle East, Russia Prepares to Fulfill the Prophecy of Gog and Magog. It's our pleasure to welcome our friend Doug Woodward back to the program. Especially, Doug, after the way the Seahawks came up just a little short this afternoon.
Yes, but it's a testimony to the conversion of my spirit and soul that I'm able to be in good spirits, despite the fact that my vaunted Seahawks have gone to a bitter defeat.
Well, so. It is tough, and I do appreciate Russell Martin being as open as he is about his faith, but I have to say that, you know, the Carolina Panthers being coached by one of the members of that 1985 Bears team, Ron Rivera, you know, it's kind of hard for me not to pull for Rivera and the Panthers. So,
oh, man. Yeah, that was a dominant team. Boy, 1985 Bears.
Yeah, the Bears.
The Bears.
Yeah, we're hoping and praying that William Refrigerator Perry is undergoing some health issues right now related to diabetes. Will be back in health soon. He's been told that he may lose a leg, but he's well over 400 pounds these days. But anyway, your book is very timely considering the geopolitical situation in the Middle East and the role that Russia is playing there. I think Vladimir Putin took the American presidency, the Obama administration, off guard with its rather muscular intervention in what's happening in Syria. I think it's, you know, we could do a whole other program on whether they should have been surprised or not. But regardless, Russia has clearly become a major player and will really influence in what's going to happen there in a part of the world that is prophetically very significant. The first Christians were based in Antioch in Syria. Some of the oldest Christian communities in the world are in northern Iraq, the Nineveh Plain, and there are those who have considered for many years that Magog represents Russia, the foe that comes from the uttermost north. But you've got a little different take on the interpretation of Ezekiel 38, specifically when you get down to about verse 10. Let's start with an overview, and then we'll start getting into specific questions. What makes your book, The Next Great War in the Middle East, different from other books that look at the prophecy of the Gog-Magog conflict?
Well, quite a few things. There's certainly a major emphasis. The first half of the book basically is really analyzing what's going on geopolitically, sort of without a whole lot of resort to biblical prophecy. It really is asking some tough questions about what is behind U.S. policy, what is the president of this administration, what is President Obama really trying to accomplish? And there's a lot of issues that I deal with there. Certainly the historical challenge between Russia and the United States, that is a major theme. But to get really to the heart of your question, there are two primary theological issues that I'm addressing. One of those has to do with the nature of identifying who Gog is, Gog from the land of Magog, which I spend a good chunk of the second part of the book talking about. And the other issue is the nature of who is the Antichrist. So there's really kind of been two major changes in Bible prophecy. There's been several, but I'd say two of the major changes in Bible prophecy. One is the work of Bill Salas, particular related to the Psalm 83 prophecy. Mm-hmm. His view is that Psalm 83 is a prophetic passage in the Scripture, and that it predicts a great war that must transpire. before the Battle of Gog and Magog can ensue. And I am challenging the way that Bill interprets that that psalm and that prophecy, which we'll get into. So I'm sort of disagreeing with Bill, and I do so respectfully because I consider Bill a friend and a very great brother, great man. And then the second issue has to do with the nature of who the Antichrist is. There's been a lot of discussion and books written over the last, I'd say, 7 years or so, on the Islamic Antichrist.
Right.
Joel Richardson, Waleed Shubat have written extensively and spoken extensively and have been sort of welcomed into the fold in terms of the eschatology community and talking about their understanding and their theory about who the Antichrist is, and so I challenge their viewpoint and believe that they are extremely wrong about their perspective on the Antichrist and the power base of the Antichrist, which they hold to be Turkey. Surprisingly, our good friend Avi Lipkin, who is indeed a good friend of ours, Avi actually agrees with them that that the Antichrist will be Islamic and that he will come from Turkey. And so I found those two issues to be sort of the prophetic factors that really have driven me to write a book that's very direct, hopefully respectful, but still very direct. And then just my own concern about American foreign policy and how America is falling into a situation in the Middle East in which America will, I think, fulfill its portion of the prophecy of the Gog and Magog passage. And, of course, we'll talk about what that is, very different than Russia's fulfillment, because I do see Russia as the principal character in Gog and Magog, which is the old conventional view of Hal Lindsey and others. But I've studied that extensively and believe that that is, in fact, what the scripture teaches and what history teaches us. And so you sort of got the foreign policy issue. You've got the Islamic Antichrist issue. You've got the nature of who is Gog and Magog and is it, rather than the Psalm 83 war, the next great war in the Middle East, hence the title of the new book.
Well, the topic's just looking at the table of contents, and in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I've only thus far been able to get through the introduction of your book, but I think this is the fourth interview I'm conducting for A View from the Bunker this week, so I've been trying to juggle that with what we've got going on just here at home and at work and so forth, but looking at the titles of the chapter titles and headings, this looks like it's a really intriguing look at history, at current foreign policy, and of course, fitting that all into a prophetic, viewing it through a prophetic lens. Mm-hmm. And I think that the questions that you're asking here regarding the assumptions about what's going to happen and in what order are valid questions, specifically and especially rather regarding the Islamic Antichrist. I think there are some issues with interpreting the prophecies as applying to somebody who would present himself as a Muslim. But let's look at how interpretation of prophecy has changed here in recent years. In the introduction, you talk a little bit about old assumptions that were made and that many of our prophetic interpretations until very recently were based on groundwork laid by or foundations laid by men like Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye. Mm-hmm. What are some of those assumptions and how have they changed in recent years?
Yeah, well, excuse me, I'm getting over the flu here. Mm-hmm. So hopefully I will not be troubled by it too much, but, certainly I lay out about eight specific kind of cardinal rules of the road, that have been the, kind of at the heart of, prophetic interpretation for those of us that are futurists that believe that there are major, prophecies yet to be fulfilled as it pertains to the second advent or the second coming of Christ. One of those certainly has to do with who is the Antichrist, the nature of the Antichrist. The traditional view is that the Antichrist will somehow be both Jewish and Roman. And J.R. Church, the late J.R. Church, in his book, Daniel Reveals the Bloodline of the Antichrist, also points out that he'll be Greek. And so actually the Antichrist comprises not coincidentally comprises in effect, a number of the prior empires, because I think that that is actually symbolic of the mystery Babylon, that that Babylon is, in effect, sort of a composite of a number of the prior empires that have existed. So that's one issue. The issue of where the Antichrist would draw his power from, the traditional view being that it's Rome or Europe, that's been one of the major threads. The nature of the U.S., USA actually be sort of missing in action, that has been the traditional view of evangelicals. The kind of the view that the Roman Catholic Church was likely to be really the fulfillment of Mystery Babylon. Gog and Magog would be the Soviet Union, would be Russia. These are sort of traditional traditional views. Now, where things have changed in today's world, one, obviously the growth of Islam. Back in the 1970s when Lindsay and LaHaye were writing, Islam was not really a major factor in the way that we were interpreting Bible prophecy. That has dramatically changed and continues to change. One could probably argue that if the Lord tarries over the next 50 years, Islam and its growth will become the issue for Christianity, mm-hmm. And it already is becoming the issue, but it certainly would continue if there is not a major war in the Middle East that influences, let's say, negatively Islam in terms of challenging the truthfulness of Islam, either through the Psalm 83 war or the Gog and Magog war. The Soviet Union kind of gave way to Turkey, the Islamic Antichrist, the idea that the Antichrist would be Islamic. And, of course, what many people may not realize is that the theory of the Antichrist being Islamic is actually it does a couple of things in terms of traditional eschatology. One is it collapses the idea that there is a separate war between Gog and Magog from the War of Armageddon. And so traditional eschatology sees those two as separate battles or wars that occur anywhere from 3.5 to 10 years apart. And whereas those that promote the Islamic Antichrist essentially see the Battle of Gog and Magog and the Battle of Armageddon as one and the same. Likewise, they also see the personage of Gog as the same as the personage of the Antichrist. So there's really no distinction from Joel Richardson's perspective or Waleed Shubat's perspective regarding who Gog is. They really believe that Gog is the Antichrist and the Antichrist is Gog, G-O-G, Gog. And so that is those are major changes in terms of eschatology. They are not easy at all to reconcile with traditional eschatology, and I spend considerable time actually develop pretty careful analysis of showing why those two points are not correct in terms of biblical eschatology and why they really do throw a wrench into the traditional scenarios and why they're really not justified from Scripture. Certainly, an area that I've emphasized a lot with my co-authors and then other authors is the issue of the United States and its position in the scheme of things in terms of geopolitics, believing that the United States is a major part, if not the villain leading up to the tribulation period as the daughter of Babylon, and as I call it, the final Babylon. It may truly actually be the second to last Babylon, because it still is conceivable that Europe, in fact, will be the final Babylon, because the position that I take in the book, not to spoiler alert, is that the United States, I argue, will be taken out as the main superpower of the world by the Russians, and then within a very short span of time, Russia will be taken out by the Lord God Himself as a means to protect Israel from Russia, and as a means to fulfill the prophecies of Ezekiel 38 and 39, in which it says that God will be glorified basically at the expense of Gog and Gog's hordes from Meshach, Tubal, Togomar, and so forth, which, of course, identifying who all those tribes are and where they come from and so forth is another big part of the story. Mm-hmm. So anyway, those are some of the key issues. There's other factors in terms of the European Union seems to have failed, and I think it will continue to fail. I think even if Europe ends up being the power base of the Antichrist in the tribulation period or the Great Tribulation, it is very likely that it won't really be the European Union per se. It'll be a global government or globalism that's been put in play perhaps by the United Nations, perhaps by the sheer power of the Antichrist and the false prophet themselves. So those are just some of the highlights.
Well, we've talked about your identity of the United States as the final Babylon before. We had the opportunity to talk about that with you and Doug Krieger and Dean McGriff, your co-authors, a couple of years back. And I'll put a link in the show notes for people who didn't hear that, rather than recovering that territory again. Mm-hmm. What struck me as interesting was identifying the United States as the place in prophecy in Ezekiel chapter 38. What is it that you find in Ezekiel 38, specifically verses 10 through 13, that says to you that the United States is to be found there, rather than identifying the nation referred to in those verses as Israel?
Right. Well, the passage is a crucial passage, and one of the things I'll start off with just to catch people's attention is that the argument for Psalm 83 as the next great war actually depends predominantly on this passage in Ezekiel 38, 10 through 13. In other words, the scenario that Brother Bill paints of Psalm 83 is based upon some core assumptions in the Ezekiel passage that I just mentioned. In other words, in the Psalm 83 prophecy, there really is no sense in it of timing or geopolitical situation in the world other than the fact that Israel has enemies that surrounds it. And, of course, that was true when Asaph wrote the psalm back in the 10th century or 9th century B.C., and it's still true today. And from that standpoint, it is absolutely a prophetic psalm. The bigger question is whether it's a ongoing fulfillment or whether it's a future fulfillment that is what we should be looking for. But specifically going back to the Ezekiel passage, verses 10, 11, and 12, and 13, let's just read through it and let me kind of talk a bit about it. I'm going to read from the King James, and there's some really interesting aspects of this. I go into kind of an original Hebrew language study of this passage because there's many elements that are really crucial. So the passage itself is, we might say, sort of pregnant with meaning. But anyway, verse 10, thus saith the Lord God, it shall also come to pass that at the same time shall things come into thy mind, and thou shalt think an evil thought. And thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, that have gotten cattle and goods, that dwell in the midst of the land, Sheba and Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? So that's the passage. Now mm-hmm. to go back and look at the verses. So one of the key issues, there's really probably two key thoughts, I should say, that are taken from this passage that really comprise the Psalm 83 theory that it is a great future war. One of those is that Israel will be dwelling safely, and secondly, quietly and at rest, and secondly, that Israel is the land of unwalled villages, all right? And mm-hmm. And so there is a In this passage, I guess I should say this way, the view is that that Israel is the land of unwalled villages.
Right.
This has actually been the standard view really throughout prophetic discourse. And I actually am challenging that view. I'm actually arguing that the land of unwalled villages is the United States and the United Kingdom and Saudi Arabia. But the predominant unwalled village, land of unwalled villages, is the United States. And there is in verse 11, it says, I will go up to them that are at rest, that dwell safely. There is a key Hebrew word that is translated either safety or safely or security, and that is the word betach, which is transliterated. The spelling would be like B-E-T-A-C-H, betach. But of course, that's just the English sort of enunciation of the Hebrew
right.
word.
Right. Yeah. No vowels in the Hebrew language. So
that's
in
right.
the Hebrew
that's right.
alphabet,
so it,
anyway,
it has that kind of a guttural sound, though, you know. And so it is. In fact, Netanyahu actually used "Shalom ve'betach" as his campaign slogan: peace and safety.
Hmm.
And so the word is it's really crucial. And what I do, and it probably is not conducive to go into real study, but what I show in doing an exposition of that word is that it's used in the King James Version like 42 times. Six times that word is used as dwelling carelessly, dwelling overconfidently. Six times it's used in that way, and then 36 times it's used as the fulfillment in the millennium of God's promise to Israel for Israel to dwell safely, securely, that it will be protected and so forth and be at peace.
Hmm.
Now, the issue is that in this verse, it has been put forward by Arnold Fruchtenbaum and Gary Stearman that Israel here is actually dwelling carelessly, dwelling overconfidently, and it is at that time that when and they, of course, they believe Israel is in the land of unwalled villages, as does Bill Salas, and it when Israel is dwelling in this sort of overconfident situation, that it will be then that Gog moves against them. And it's really interesting because if that is true, if in effect Israel is the subject of this verse, as it turns out in the scripture, it would be the only time in which the word betach is used as a pejorative, as a criticism against Israel in the entire Bible. Meaning that it probably isn't Israel that is the subject of this, because the six places in the scripture where it is used in a pejorative, it's always talking about the enemies of God. It's talking about Nineveh. It's talking about the daughter of Babylon. It talks about the city of Laish, which is where the Danites conquered the city in the book of Judges.
Right.
It talks
right.
about Ethiopia. In other words, every time that the word is translated in the King James carelessly and so forth or overconfidently, it is used as a criticism against the enemies of God. But it is assumed that in this point in verses 10 through 13, that here betach is being used as a criticism of Israel. And I argue, no, it's not. And the reason is if you look at the nature of the unwalled villages, first off, we know that Israel is not a land of unwalled villages today.
You still have the wall there between the Palestinian territories and the West Bank.
Yeah, it's a wall that Donald Trump would clearly love to emulate on the border of America.
Yeah.
Because it's a 417-mile-long wall. And also, the other aspect of this is it indicates that that who is coming against the land of unwalled villages appears to be willing to take or eager to take a spoil. And so it's assumed that Israel, if Israel is the subject, Israel has gone through a process in which it no longer needs its walls. It is dwelling safely and securely, and it has taken us. It itself is wealthy, so much so that Gog wants to come against them to take their wealth. And so the theory that's been advanced about Psalm 83 is that Israel conquers all of its neighbors, the inner ring immediately surrounding Israel, and that it causes Israel to dwell in security and safety. And Joel Richardson, who I actually criticize for his Islamic Antichrist, points out that based upon the interpretation of Psalm 83 that he does not agree with, as I do not agree with, so he and I agree on this point, that that Psalm 83 would actually suggest that Israel would probably have consummated a 200 million person Holocaust around its borders by eradicating many, many, many Arabs and nations, and it would have conquered them and would have taken away all of their wealth and so forth. And he poses the question, which I do as well, that is that really realistic to believe that Israel, A, desires to do that, and B, that the world would let Israel get away with something like that? And so I believe the answer is no, it would not. And so I don't believe that that Gog is coming after Israel because Israel has great wealth, nor do I believe that Gog is looking at Israel because Israel or would come against Israel at this time because Israel dwells securely. Israel does not dwell securely currently. It, I don't believe, will dwell securely when Gog moves against it. And then there's a whole bunch in this. Obviously, that's why I wrote a whole book about it. But looking at verse 13, Sheba and Dedan, the merchants of Tarshish, the young lions, Sheba and Dedan, scholars have normally looked at that and believe those are tribes that relate to Middle Eastern countries, specifically the Arab states. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Saudi Arabia, the Arab Emirates, Qatar, so forth, Yemen, and the Arab states in the Saudi Arabian or the Arabian Peninsula. And the merchants of Tarshish, virtually everyone agrees that we're dealing with European nations, probably England. It is true that Tartessos in Spain could be the reference to Tarshish, but most scholars tend to believe, as does, for instance, Bill Salas, that Tarshish really refers to England. Huh. And it is interesting that the term for its young lions, which we would gather to be the colonies, that it's using the term lions. Well, of course, England is the lion,
right?
And whereas Russia is the bear. But the fact that it has young lions, which we could think of certainly the United States, Canada, the Americas in general, in terms of Spain, Portugal, England, of course, having colonized the New World. Nevertheless, it would certainly seem to be likely that what we're dealing with here is Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Specifically, what we're dealing with really here, these are people that are focused, nations or entities focused on the question of wealth. Because it says, art thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou gathered thy company to take a prey, to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Well, if you were to today identify what is the source of global wealth, you know, who runs the economy, what is sort of the axis of evil economy, if you will, you would really identify these three entities. You'd identify Wall Street in the United States. You'd identify the city of London in the United Kingdom. And you'd identify Saudi Arabia with the support for the petrodollar standard. And so it's intriguing that it is really, from an economic standpoint, it's these entities that are the powerhouses of the world. And if I really wanted to accomplish the greatest amount of wealth accumulation in a single stroke, the way I would do that is I would find a way to, in effect, destroy the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. And because if I'm the BRICS nations, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, they happen to owe something in the neighborhood of $1.2 trillion in debt to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund,
which is just a rounding error for the U.S. Department of Defense.
Yes,
but that's
yes. Yeah. Well, it's trillion as opposed to billion, of course, and so in effect, the way that one could accomplish the greatest amount of wealth creation, if I'm Russia, and if I'm hurting economically because of the price of oil and all of that, is I would find a way to take out the City of London and Wall Street.
And then also force Saudis, whether by coercion or just by conquest, to quit pumping so much.
Yeah. Well, and isn't it interesting that Iran, who happens to the Persia, of course, is an ally of Gog in the Battle of Gog and Magog.
Yeah.
And of course, now it's very easy to see that Iran could choose to attack the House of Saud. Mm-hmm. Could move against Saudi Arabia, although, of course, Pakistan has threatened that they would destroy Iran if they did that. Nevertheless, it's not inconceivable that you could have Persia moving against Sheba and Dedan. So the usual argument is verse 13 is, are these three entities protesting that Gog has chosen to attack Israel, and it's just a lame protest? My position is that no. These nation states, these peoples are not protesting Gog attacking Israel. They are protesting Gog attacking them. And so they are astonished that they are under attack. They are surprised and stunned that Gog has moved against them. And so it is, then it dawns upon them that perhaps Gog is doing so as a result of a desire to gather spoil, to take away their silver and their gold.
Hmm. Livestock and goods, and of course, livestock is the center part of the United States. Especially now, since we moved down here to southwest corner of Missouri, we can see how important livestock is to the economy.
Well, if you're the prophet Ezekiel and you're living in 550 BC, the source of wealth in that day and age was not Middle Eastern oil,
no.
And it wasn't the fractional banking system. It was silver and gold and cattle and goods.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So it's that is how wealth was denominated. Today, the wealth is still denominated in the petrodollar, even for the BRICS nations, by the way. Although they put $100 billion into it, it is still a dollar-denominated bank, believe it or not.
Mm-hmm. So what role does Turkey play in all of this? Because there are still those who will look at the nations mentioned earlier in chapter 38 of Ezekiel, Meshech, Tubal, the house of Togarmah. Yeah. And
all right.
And those, generally speaking, are identified by scholars as located in Asia Minor, Anatolia, what we consider modern day Turkey.
Right.
What role do they play? What role does Turkey play in all of this?
Yeah, there's two chapters that I deal with the whole issue of Turkey. One of them has to do with really kind of the geopolitical issues going on in Turkey today. Who is Erdogan, the president? Mm-hmm. And I don't even want to venture to try to pronounce his first and middle name, but his last name is pronounced Erdogan.
I'm reliably informed it's
spelled that way.
I'm reliably informed it's Recep Tayyip. A fellow who was an expat teaching English in Turkey for several years, Recep, the first name.
Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that's close anyway. But
I will just call him President Erdogan.
Good call.
Yes. And so one chapter deals with what's going on with Turkey, the fact that Turkey, the issue of whether or not the Ottoman Empire is likely to be reborn, revived. It is the analogy that Waleed Shabbat and Joel Richardson use is the mortal head wound that is healed, and they believe that refers not to a European Roman Empire revival, but to an Ottoman Empire revival. And so I talk about whether or not that is likely and is conceivable, and I believe that it is highly unlikely.
Seems like a bit of a stretch, just for me. I mean, it seems like when you're dealing with the head wound that is healed, you're talking about an individual and not so much the making an allegory about the political state of a particular nation.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to know. You certainly see scholars that have for a long time taken both sides of that, and it's even conceivable that both may end up being fulfilled at more or less at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
that there is an individual who is attempted to assassinate him, and he is revived, resurrected from the dead, if you will, through a satanic deception, as well as the possibility that it could be a nation state that was more or less destroyed, but it somehow is revived in a remarkable turnaround. And in that turnaround, it causes all the nations of the world to wonder after it. So you could see both potentially happening simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I believe that, I go in and I talk about the nature of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. I talk about what's happening with Erdogan. I talk about his position. Certainly the fact that it is on the outs with Russia. To some extent, it's on the outs with NATO.
Yeah.
And it's becoming somewhat isolated. Now, the political climate in Turkey could change virtually overnight if there was a regime change. And goodness knows this is probably yet another regime that the current administration in the United States would probably love to see a regime change, because they're not that friendly with Erdogan, despite the fact that he is a the head of state in a NATO nation.
Well, he definitely tried to pull NATO into the conflict with Russia with shooting down that Russian Su-24 and then running to NATO for assistance. It's also there's also enough evidence, I think, to suggest that it's plausible that the sarin gas that was deployed in Syria a couple of years ago, which crossed that infamous red line drawn by President Obama, was actually deployed by Syrian rebels in conjunction with Turkish intelligence, the goal being to force President Obama's hand, bring American soldiers in on the side of the rebels in order to depose Bashar Assad. The Turks have wanted to get rid of the House of Assad for quite some time. Several generations of Assad.
That's absolutely true. There's a lot of theories about false flag operations there as it relates to the chemical warfare.
Right.
And what we do know is that Turkey has been, Erdogan has been hopeful to be able to take out Bashar al-Assad for a number of years. We know that that Russia, Putin, despises, Erdogan, and Erdogan despises Putin. So we know that that's going on. And then we also know that that NATO is becoming more increasingly reluctant to necessarily agree that it, should Turkey get into a firefight with Russia, that NATO wants to necessarily step into that and come to Turkey's defense.
Yeah.
So you have Turkey, in effect, isolating itself more and more. You have a nation that would like to be the caliphate again. They have been working with ISIS to some extent.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're supposed to be opposing ISIS, but they are. Turkey is a Sunni nation. ISIS is predominantly a Sunni-driven movement, and despite the fact that there really isn't room in the Middle East for two caliphates, it does appear that Turkey continues to work with ISIS. And, of course, as a quick sidebar, one of the things I talk about to a great extent in the book is whether or not the United States has actually been working with ISIS, secretly supporting ISIS through weapons shipments through Benghazi and so forth, which is another, of course, major discussion point that I take up in the book.
Well, the Defense Intelligence Agency said so in so many words in a memo, an analysis that was obtained by Judicial Watch a while back from August of 2012, basically warned the White House, stop doing this because you're going to create a group that will rise up and create an independent Islamic state that will destabilize both Syria and Iraq. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah,
Sharon and I talked about that on the PID radio on the 17th. Because, yeah, that's very clear that that is indeed what happened. We were running guns from the stash collected by Muammar Gaddafi after his death, in the infamous words of Hillary Clinton, we came, we saw, he died, ha ha. And that's what got Ambassador Christopher Stevens killed and the other men.
Other famous statement that she made is, what difference does it make?
Yeah, what difference does it make? Well, what we see what, yeah, if, well.
It makes a lot of difference, doesn't it?
Amen, it does.
It makes a lot of difference. Now, chapter I talk about in terms of Turkey is really looking at the whole issue of the tribes, the so-called Table of Nations from Genesis 10.
Yes, yes.
all of these individual nations, where they settled. I do. I pulled together a lot of research from a number of sources and actually create, you know, sort of some tables of my own, you might say. I have a chapter called the Sons of Japheth.
Right.
Japheth, of course, being one of the three sons of Noah. And it's really through Japheth's lineage, his seven sons, that Eurasia, basically Europe and Asia, and for the most part, the New World was really settled.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't be quite right to say just the Gentiles, because Ham, the son of Noah, settled most of Africa, a little bit of the Middle East, and of course Shem settled mostly in the Middle East, lower portions of Asia, and some in North Africa and so forth. So that's sort of how the nations of the world have been split up. But one of the there's a whole lot of arguments that I advance, but one of the points is that if you were Ezekiel and you were living in 550 BC, you would already recognize that Asia is a vast continent. You would already know that that there are the Gogarenes, the Gogarians that have settled to the north of the Caucasus region, north of the Black and Caspian Seas. You would know that the Asian steppes have been settled. That the peoples that are talked about, in other words, in Ezekiel 38, they weren't just in Turkey. Now, they all started in Turkey, but keep in mind, Noah began in Turkey after the ark settled.
Yes.
Everybody started in Turkey.
Right. Yeah.
And the dispersion of the sons of Noah had been going on for not quite, but almost 2,000 years before Ezekiel wrote his prophecies.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's strong evidence that, in fact, what I do is I show all the peoples of Eurasia and where they come from in terms of the seven sons of Japheth, whether we're talking about Greeks, the English, the Russians, the Chinese, whoever we're talking about, we talk about and show where they basically have come from by doing an analysis of people and place names across the world to point out that one cannot argue that because Ezekiel talks about Meshach and Tubal, and particularly Ross, Rus, that that we're just dealing with peoples in Anatolia, Cappadocia, and so forth around the Caspian and Black Seas. We're talking about peoples that settled throughout Eurasia, and the people in the Middle East knew the world was great big. It's even arguable that Solomon, 400 years before Ezekiel, knew about the New World and was working with his cousins, the Canaanites, in trading, mm-hmm. in terms of exploiting resources in the New World.
Yeah,
it's possible that 1,000 years before Ezekiel, the giants of Canaan had knew about the New World, and they went to hide away from Joshua and Caleb.
Yeah, yeah.
Into the New World. So
the theory of L.A. Marzulli.
There's really not a good argument to say that. In fact, one of the main arguments that Joel Richardson pursues is just, well, you know, this was in the Scofield Bible, and that Russia was is Gog. And that's just, that's a very bad, it's very bad scholarship. We know that, that Scofield, we can't really rely upon Scofield as a scholar and so on. Of course, the reality is that Scofield wrote about 80 to 90 years after a guy named Jacinius, who was actually a great Hebrew and ancient languages scholar, and talked in terms of Ross or Rus being the nation. He wrote it was published in 1850, but he wrote this in probably 1830. he indicated that the Russians, who at that time were already in competition, of course, with the English, he wrote that the Russians would likely be the fulfillment of of Gog. Oh, pardon me for my cough. And so I get into another discussion about whether or not Russia and the Rus and Ross and so forth is actually, as many argue, that it just means the sort of the chief priest, mm-hmm. or chief of princes, or whether it actually means Russia. And the argument is, I think, quite strong that it actually means Russia, that the Rus were known as peoples that existed even in the time of Ezekiel. They were certainly known in the time of the Septuagint when it was written, about 300 years before Christ. And so there's a strong argument that, excuse me, that Russia is not just a, sort of a memory of the Cold War, and that Schofield is not really the responsible party for causing our scholarship in eschatology to assume that Russia is Gog, that it's not due to those things. It's really due to the fact that the Russians, the people that lived north of the Caspian Sea, the Gogarians or Gog, they were known as, in fact, even the Caucasus Mountains itself. Mark Hitchcock argues that Caucasus really means Gog's fort.
Huh.
And so, and of course, the Scythians were talked about by Philo, not Philo, but Josephus.
Mm-hmm.
So as one goes in to look at the ancient scholars, as well as more recent scholars, demographers, if you will, you can understand that the arguments that we're dealing with Turkey versus dealing with Eurasia and Russia, the arguments for Turkey are pretty weak. And so so that's why I conclude that, no, the traditional scholarship of, let's say, Hal Lindsey, John Woolford, other dispensational scholars regarding Russia, that we are dealing with the Russians. And so it is one of the major points that I'm making. Turkey will not be the power base of the Antichrist. The Antichrist, although Islam is a tremendous concern in terms of the radical elements of Islam and jihadists and so forth, it is still not, in my view, it is not a good argument from the standpoint of eschatological scholarship to suppose the Antichrist is Islamic and that Turkey is the power base and that Gog and the Antichrist are the same and that the Battle of Gog and Magog is the same as the Battle of Armageddon.
Mm. Now, I look forward to reading that section, especially on the Table of Nations. For some reason, that sort of historical study just really, you know, fascinates me. So I'm looking forward to reading that. But in the last section, because time is really flying by here,
sure,
of the interview here, I want to talk about the geopolitical reality. There may be some Americans hearing this who get offended at the idea that Russia could somehow take out the United States. What mm-hmm. leads you to believe that Russia is a serious threat militarily?
Mm-hmm. Well, I spend probably 50 pages in the book really addressing the whole issue of what's going on with Russia's military. Why is Russia potentially capable of attacking the United States? How, you know, why is it a real threat? Certainly in your prior show, which I have not listened to yet, which I hope to listen to, with my buddy Ben Baruch. Ben Baruch and Jeff Nyquist, of course, wrote a book called The New Tactics of Global Global War, and in that book they raised the, you know, sort of the specter of a nuclear attack from Russia, and there's a whole slew of arguments there in terms of the fact that really Russia, today's Russia, and to some extent, to a great extent, is a continuation of the Soviet Union, not the same ideology, but nevertheless, we're still dealing with Russian nationalism. And, of course, Vladimir Putin has been in power really since about 2000, for about the last 15 years, either himself or through Medvedev, the president, who is really sort of president in name only. That Putin has been bringing and building up the Russian military. Now, The point I make in the book is that Russia does not need to be able to project military power the same as the U.S. The U.S. can project military power anywhere in the world. Russia does not need to. Russia needs to protect its borders, and it needs to project power predominantly in really strategic areas, which mostly include, mostly focuses on Eastern Europe, i.e. the Ukraine, and the Middle East, i.e. Syria, the Balkans, Iran, the Fertile Crescent, and so forth. Russia is extremely well equipped to do that. When the U.S. pulled out of Iraq in 2011, Russia, of course, began to move in more and more. It's been in Syria and has had a base in Syria for several decades. When the U.S. completely pulled out, and when the U.S. started to move against Assad in 2014, Russia eventually has come to the defense of Assad. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
No.
I apologize so much for my cough, but it's a result of having the flu for the last.
No, I appreciate
week.
You being willing to come on and talk. You know, just days after you were essentially laid up in bed.
Right.
The United States, for some reason, has been provoking Russia with yes. some of our foreign policy initiatives. We were behind not one but two regime changes within the recent past in Ukraine. The Orange Revolution during right. the Bush administration, which was financed in large part by the Open Society Institute, which is George Soros's organization. Mm-hmm. And as much as American conservatives love to vilify George Soros, he was receiving funds from the Bush State Department,
right.
which were then
right.
being plowed into the movement in Ukraine that led to the...
yes, you're so right. It's the whole issue of American foreign policy. And of course, I talk a lot about that in this book and talk about the concept of the color revolutions. Why is it that Russia, goes after and seeks to gain superior weapon systems?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it is because Russia does feel to some extent threatened by by the United States and its policy, which has really been in play through the CIA since the 1950s, to destabilize regions of the world where it perceives that, in times past, that Marxism could gain a footing, or in today's world where Russia could get undue influence. And so Putin points out, and I quote, several places where he talks to American reporters, such as Charlie Rose in 60 Minutes, where he talks about the concept of America destabilizing Libya, Egypt, certainly, Iraq,
mm-hmm.
and Syria, and says that, the U.S. policy appears to be, if you won't join with us in the West, we will essentially destroy your nation, turn it into a failed state, and create chaos there. And he has a pretty strong argument. And of course, there is a pattern. I know a guy named Tim Weiner wrote a book called Legacy of Ashes, which is about an 800-page study on the CIA and covert operations. And essentially, whether we're talking Eisenhower, Kennedy, whoever we're talking about, certainly George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, every American president has used the CIA and covert operations to attempt to take down regimes that are not friendly to the U.S.
Right.
An interesting point that we probably won't have time to talk about today, but it bears study, is the investigative journalist Seymour Hersh published
yes.
Just 2 weeks ago. I don't know if you talked about this in your program or not, but he published a study that was published in the London Review of Books talking about what's been going on within the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Essentially, what he was saying is that there has been a conflict, in my interpretation, a conflict between the CIA and the Pentagon,
mm-hmm.
and that the Pentagon has been gathering intelligence that it thought would be helpful to Bashar al-Assad,
right.
and pass that intelligence to Germany, to Israel, hoping that or intending it to leak back to Assad.
And to Russia.
And to Russia, thank you, to enable them to overcome and defeat ISIS.
Yes.
Even though the CIA has been running guns, as we know about, through Benghazi, through Turkey, across mm-hmm. the Turkish border into Syria as a means to try to destabilize and overthrow Assad. So, in effect, you have had a soft or quiet coup that has occurred in the executive branch of the government, which, of course, the military reports into the executive branch, and the CIA, intelligence department, does as well. In effect, you've got a conflict going on between the Pentagon and the CIA. And I find it just absolutely astounding that the media is keeping this quiet.
Yeah.
Now, I shouldn't find it astounding because it is such a destabilizing thing, I think, in our government to say that essentially the Joint Chiefs of Staff are not taking orders from the president when it suits them.
Yeah, I talked about this on Skywatch TV when the report was published by Hirsch a couple of weeks ago. We talked about it on PID Radio again over this past weekend.
All right.
But yeah, this is as close as the Joint Chiefs of Staff have come to a 7 days in May type situation as they can get without actually crossing that line.
That's right.
They're, as I understand Hirsch's reporting, they were so concerned by the Obama administration's insistence on sticking with this plan of overturning Bashar Assad in spite of what the Defense Intelligence Agency was warning, which was that they would create an Islamic state that would destabilize the region, Syria and Iraq, and lead to bigger problems that would need to be cleaned up. A failed state similar to what we have in Libya, where now the Islamic State is taking over the oil fields. The Brits just deployed SAS, special forces, basically, to try to retake those from the Libyans. Disturbingly, there's also some evidence that has been disclosed through the releases of Hillary Clinton's emails from her private server that what was going on there was the French under Nicolas Sarkozy was were interested in taking down Gaddafi because he was trying to create a new currency based on the gold reserves held by the Libyan government, which would have reduced French influence in its former colonies in North Africa. That's a whole nother story. It's a tangled web, but the bottom line is the Joint Chiefs of Staff, rather than directly opposing the White House, which they believe they could not do, have been quietly opening back channel communications and slipping intelligence that they knew would get to Assad. And then just hoping that Assad would be smart enough to use it to stay afloat because they don't want. Essentially, they were trying to circumvent the White House policy of overthrowing Assad.
Correct.
Which, again, that's as close as treason as you. And, you know, Americans ought to be.
It depends on who's treasonous, right?
Well, exactly right. Yes.
In other words, the current. And I talk, of course, about this in the book. I talk extensively about the issue of what Obama's policy in the Middle East is or has been, or to what extent he doesn't really have a strategy.
Right.
And policy. And this is a big element of it, which is this whole issue of ISIS. To what extent has he really been supporting ISIS as opposed to, in effect, trying to degrade and destroy, as he said back in July of 2014?
Yeah.
You know, it really has been another level to this that we haven't talked about is what is it that Obama really was trying to achieve with the Iranian deal? The nuclear deal, and why did Obama choose to turn his backs on the moderate Sunni states, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and so forth? He did not even tell them that he was negotiating with the Shia, in effect, because many scholars talk about this, and I record this in the book, that the Obama government, the Obama administration has decided that the Shia would be a more stabilizing and secure influence in the Middle East than the Sunnis. And therefore, he had decided that he would, in effect, do the Iranian nuclear deal predominantly to endow the Shiites, predominantly Iran, not Assad, because that. Well, that's another issue.
That's the thing that doesn't make any sense, though, because Assad, even though he's Alawite is like an offshoot of Shia Islam, and they're certainly backed by the Shia, which are in the minority in Syria. So that's what doesn't make any. His policy
is self-contradictory.
It's incoherent.
Yeah. The other thing, though, and this is why there's sort of several threads that comprise the policy. I talk about this. They do not necessarily coexist very well.
No.
One of the broadest policies. That Obama continues to play under the influence of Zinoviev Brzezinski is trying to undermine Russia. And so on the one hand, Obama wants to support Islam. He wants to pull back from, away from Israel because he believes that American policy with Israel has caused us to alienate the Muslims. And so he wants to create sunlight and distance between Israel and the United States. So that's one element. He wants to empower the Shia to create stability in the region because he trusts Iran to be the quote-unquote natural leader of the region. And yet he wants to take out Assad because he perceives, apparently, this is best I can figure, he perceives Assad's presence in Syria to give Russia too much leverage, to give Russia too much power in the region, and therefore he wants Assad to come out. So these things are all sort of working and jumbled together. And there isn't necessarily a great way to rationalize all these things.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's incoherent. There are some suggestions and evidence to suggest that this is all about oil or natural gas. That when
you can bet that it's part of it.
Yeah, that Assad kind of sealed his fate as far as America was concerned when Assad turned down an offer by Qatar and Saudi Arabia to be part of a natural gas pipeline from the west side of the Persian Gulf from Qatar up through Syria and then out to a port there in Syria, instead signing an agreement to build an Islamic pipeline from Iran through Iraq, because Iran taps into the same natural gas field, but just from the east side of the Persian Gulf.
Yes.
But then while you've got that going on, then again, in that context, the nuclear deal with Iran and freeing up up to $150 billion in frozen assets to Iran, which is he just did today or yesterday, as we record this on Sunday the 17th, by executive order. So, again, it's incoherent. Watching this administration at work in the Middle East is like watching a group of drunken college students playing a game of double board Risk.
Well said, sir.
Keep rolling the dice and slamming the shots until something happens, and because the overall strategy makes no sense. And our friend Colonel Bob McGinnis tells us from an insider's perspective that what they have done in the White House with regard to foreign policy is going to take decades to fix, if it can be fixed at all.
At all. Yeah, no, I agree. And again, that's why I spent so much time in the front part of the book explaining, you know, what has really happened in the Middle East. Why is the U.S., you know, kind of back to one of your questions, you know, why is the U.S. at risk? Well, the U.S. is at risk because it's essentially deserted the balance of power doctrine in the Middle East. It's basically goes back to the Treaty of Westphalia back in 1648, if I'm not mistaken. And essentially said the U.S. basically pulled out of Iraq. It essentially deserted its post. It created a power vacuum, allowing Russia to come in. You had also a desire on the part of Obama, as I said, to support Islam to some extent, believing that was in the best interest. I think he believed it was in the best interest of the United States to kind of pull back on our support of Israel and support Iran and other Muslim states. And it was better to sort of wash our hands of the whole affair. But it is a very tangled web. And ultimately, of course, what I'm arguing is that because of the very many geopolitical factors involved in this, it's a very high stakes game, that Russia is in the Middle East. It will not leave the Middle East. It will find ways to increase its strength. And as the prophet says, God is going to put hooks in the jaws of Gog and draw him ever more into the whole situation of the Middle East. And pretty much against his will to some extent, because I don't know that Putin necessarily, if he is Gog, and I think he may be, that he necessarily wants to be drawn into World War III or wants to start it. But because of things that are going on, the strategic value of energy, the fact that the oil situation, the price of oil falling as it is, it's absolutely devastating the Russian economy, and is going to get worse and worse as 2016 goes along.
Yeah, well, it's not helping the U.S. much either, I can tell you, from having seen a lot of the oil fields of southern Illinois and
that's
seeing,
right.
And you know, being from Chicago, I had no idea they were pumping as much oil out of Illinois as they were. But compared to what's coming out of Texas and Oklahoma, it's nothing. But right, they were expecting a boom and figured they were on the verge of one, similar to the one in western North Dakota with the Bakken shale play out there, potentially having tripled the reserves of Saudi Arabia.
Right.
The geology under southern Illinois is very similar to that in western North Dakota. So there were a lot of people buying up leases for mineral rights in the southern third of Illinois and expecting that they were going to pay off big starting in 15 and 16. And that has collapsed. Once the price of oil dropped below $80, it's like, okay, well, no new drilling. But now at below $30, there's really, you know, they start deferring maintenance on those pump jacks. It's really... Not
well,
good.
The point I would make, Derek, is that with oil under $30 a barrel, you cannot have a steady state. You cannot have a status quo. It will force a conflict in the Middle East.
Exactly. When even the Saudis are having to cut their budget, which has happened, and may lead to some conflict there because no longer are they underwriting the price of fuel, the price of electricity, and the price of water for its citizens. They may see a little unrest. And there was a map that I saw just a couple of weeks ago, which really leads to some interesting analysis that even in Saudi Arabia, in the Middle East, most of the big oil and natural gas fields, even in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, which is majority Shia, are located in areas occupied predominantly by Shia Muslims. The eastern part of Saudi Arabia is where its wells are located and where its oil and gas reserves are located, and those areas are mainly occupied by Shia Muslims. So,
this is really intriguing.
In the Middle East, between Iran, southeastern Iraq, and eastern Saudi Arabia, the Shias are sitting on top of the oil wealth, but it's the Sunnis who have political dominance over most of it.
Right, and of course that, you know, you've got a number of tensions going on in the Middle East, and that is yet another one of the major ones right there.
Exactly.
So, you know, so the idea that you know, that we are somehow sitting on a time of peace in the Middle East because of the Iranian deal. That is one of the great laughs, tragedies, really, of our time as we sit here, just as you pointed out, on the Sunday in which, you know, the news media is talking about this. And there's a number of analysts, at least on the more liberal stations like a CNN, that network, that would say, oh, well, you know, things are going to be better now. Things are going to be explosive.
Yeah.
And I would predict that there is going to be, before too long, a next great war in the Middle East. I don't necessarily believe that it's going to be Israel conquering its neighbors. I do believe that it's going to relate to Russia moving more and more against the United States' interest in the Middle East and ultimately against Israel. And I think we're on the cusp of something happening this year and certainly in the very near term.
Yeah, and hence the name of the book, The Next Great War in the Middle East, Russia Prepares to Fulfill the Prophecy of Gog and Magog. Doug Woodward, the author. Doug, when and where will people be able to get the book?
All right. Well, the good news is that it is now available on Amazon, and it will also be available on Kindle, really, as it turns out, tonight. So as people hear this, it should be available both in hard copy, well, not a hardback, but a hard copy as in a paperback, as well as in Kindle virtually right away. So you can find it under that title or look up S. Douglas Woodward, S as in Stephen Douglas Woodward, and should be available there. It should be available within 2 weeks on iBooks and out on Lulu as well. And so it should be available essentially in all of the ebook formats as well as through Amazon and its distributors. It's also available through Prophecy in the News. And don't know that it's being sold yet at Skywatch TV, but I'd be very happy for it to be.
We'll put in a word, and we'll put links to all the places where you can find it in the show notes at vftb.net. Doug, great to talk with you as always. We look forward to seeing you, if not sooner, then certainly at the Prophecy Conference in July. And this fascinating conversation. We'll talk again as things develop out there in the Middle East.
Super. Thanks so much, Derek.
The notes for the show posted at vftb.net, and there you'll find a link to Doug's website, faith-happens.com, and links to where you can get a copy of the new book, The Next Great War in the Middle East. And some interesting stuff in there. I've got a pile to try to read through as quickly as I can, and I'm trying to get some stuff written, but I am trying to make time to read on a daily basis. So I really do find a lot of the chapter headings in Doug's book really intriguing. So I think this is going to compel me to sit down and plow through this in a hurry. But that is next on the list. Another book that I'm looking forward to reading here in the very near future. Well, I'll tell you about a couple of those. In fact, one I've already read, but a couple more that I'm looking forward to getting through here pretty quickly. Just a couple of very quick news notes. And then this one I think is timely because of the discussion we just had with Doug. And that is, a couple of announcements, a couple of news items related to conflict in the Middle East. There are sources reporting this weekend, as I record this on the 24th of January, that America and Turkey have begun a ground invasion of Syria. Now, I've got to double check these sources, so don't take this as gospel, but the article is drawing from a number of different news sources, Al Jazeera, the Donbass News Agency, RT, Sputnik News, not all exactly objective sources. We try to triangulate from multiple sources to find the truth somewhere in between. But it does appear that U.S. and Turkish forces are on the ground in northern Syria. The question is whether they're there to go after the Islamic State, which is what's being claimed, or if the Turks are doing this to try to drive a wedge between Kurdish forces, the PKK and the YPG. The PKK, which is considered a terrorist organization, even by the U.S. State Department, and of course the Turks hate them even more, and the YPG, another Kurdish militia unit, and the Turks just, they do not want an independent Kurdistan on their southeastern border because there's a big chunk of southeastern Turkey that is majority Kurd. So it's up for question yet what exactly is going on and what the goal is. The big question, of course, the biggest question about this particular initiative is how Russia will respond. Syria is getting crowded with troops on the ground from not just the Syrian army and, of course, the rebels, various flavors of rebel, fighting against the Assad government. But Russia has troops on the ground. Iran, Hezbollah. And then, of course, on the opposite side, you've got the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State, and then other groups. And then, of course, you got the Kurds who are fighting against both of those groups. They don't like the Assad government. They don't like the Turks. They don't like the Islamic State. They've got de facto independence now on the Syrian side and the Iraqi side of the Turkish border. But the Turks don't want that to give the Turkish Kurds any ideas. So, again, reports that U.S. and Turkish troops are in Syria's northern province of Hasaka, purportedly to support the Kurds against the Islamic State, but it could be that they're there to actually keep a lid on the Kurdish expansion. The other news item, and again, this is one that will require independent confirmation because the news source, even though I draw on it fairly frequently, I'm beginning to get a little cautious about reports from these guys because I don't have a way to independently confirm what they report. This is Debka.com, Debka file, which claims sources in the intelligence community of Israel and in the United States. But there are other respected sources I look at that treat Debka as just a collection of conspiracy theories. So hard to say, but Debka is reporting this weekend publicly, and they reported 2 weeks ago to their subscribers that the United States, in conjunction with Russia, Italy, England, and France, have quietly landed in Libya at a couple of locations, one near Tobruk, which is where the internationally recognized government is located, and another group force near the town of Sirte, S-I-R-T-E, which is on the northern coast. And the goal apparently is to head off the Islamic State's goal in Libya of capturing the oil fields and the oil transfer points on the Mediterranean Sea. So the surprise is that Russia is a part of this coalition, if this information is correct. Now, there are some mainstream news sources that are reporting that the British SAS forces that we told you about earlier this week are in fact on the ground. About 1,000 SAS troops, that's British equivalent of the Green Berets, they're preparing the ground for the landing of American, French, Italian, and Russian forces. And apparently the Russians added at the last minute. The Italians, well, the French have a special interest in much of Africa. I was not aware that Francophone Africa, French-speaking Africa, comprises about half the continent. And emails that were released from Hillary Clinton's stash, her private server, on New Year's Eve, while we were all distracted, which was exactly the reason they were released on New Year's Eve, discloses that her advisor, Sidney Blumenthal, longtime Clinton advisor, revealed that Nicolas Sarkozy, who was president of France prior to François Hollande, wanted to invade to head off a couple of things. First of all, Muammar Gaddafi was in the process of releasing a gold-backed currency that could be used across Africa, a pan-African currency. Now, those Francophone nations in Africa still use the French franc as currency. And I wasn't aware of that. So replacing that with a gold-backed currency, the Libyan dinar, would reduce French influence in much of Africa. If you want to go on the web and do a quick search for Francophone Africa, you'll be surprised at how many nations in Africa still speak French. So, and Blumenthal's email said that Sarkozy was wanting to head off this Libyan currency. He wanted to head off Gaddafi's growing influence in North Africa. He wanted to shore up public opinion at home. I mean, Sarkozy was facing re-election, and you get France into a war against some, you know, evil outside dictator like Muammar Gaddafi, and well, you know, it's wag the dog. You gin up a war, and suddenly you get all the troops, or all the folks at home, the voters getting all patriotic, and you increase your chances. It's a time-honored tradition. The Romans were doing it 2,000 years ago. Those nasty Parthians! And it's going on today. It's just kind of disgusting seeing it spelled out so blatantly in an email. And you can find all of these posted at the website of Judicial Watch, which is the government watchdog group that's been a thorn in the side of Washington, D.C. since the Clinton administration. So anyway, the French wanted to invade to head that off, to shore up, and also to show that to raise the prestige of the French military at home and around the world. Give the French military a chance to go out and kick some butt and take some names. Well, that's what happened 2011. We went in, we broke the country, killed Gaddafi. In the words of Hillary Clinton, we came, we saw, he died. And she did the laugh, too. And now Libya is a broken state. It is a jumping-off point for refugees seeking asylum in Europe. And the Italians are concerned about that because they're the closest point for people sailing from Libya. Libya is also an oil-rich country. And those oil transfer points on the Mediterranean are worth a lot of money. Oh, and that was the other thing. French oil companies like Total, was it Total, Fina, and Elf wanted a bigger share of Libyan oil. And apparently Gaddafi was making deals with the Chinese. So it's like the movie Syriana. You start running afoul of the faceless men in boardrooms back in London and New York and D.C., and next thing you know, you're dead. So Libya is now a failed state. You've got two competing governments, one internationally recognized, one comprised of a group of Islamist radicals, and then you've got the Islamic State that's fighting both of them and taking over the oil fields. So hence the British SAS troops preparing the ground, apparently for U.S., Russian, French, and Italian forces to go in and invade. Now, again, this is reported only at Debka. Want to see some independent confirmation, but there are stories out there on other mainstream websites, mainstream news organizations saying, you know, just reporting interesting comments like the head of U.S. Special Forces, General Joseph Votel, who's nominated to take over CENTCOM, that we need to do something more muscular to respond to Libya, because the West is watching the Islamic State gaining strength in Libya. And so I would not be surprised to see that as a new front in the ongoing eternal global war on terror. But it is an interesting development if Debka's information is correct, that the Russians are part of this coalition. Now, the Russians, with their provinces just in the Caucasus, Chechnya in particular, having fought a long, long war against Chechen separatists, most of whom are Muslim, they don't want to give radical Sunni Muslims another foothold in southern Russia. So for them, it's personal. It's closer to home for the Russians than it is for us. But we shall see. Things are certainly turning, and it just feels like things are moving more and more quickly with each passing week. Well, we'll find out. Is the next battlefield on the war on ISIS Libya? Keep an eye on that. We'll be talking about that in the weeks and months ahead, no doubt. One other quick thing. You may have heard of this already. The Zika, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Z-I-K-A, Zed, if you're outside the United States, virus, which is a new mosquito-borne, well, it's not new, it was discovered in 1947, but it's new to us here in the Western Hemisphere, a virus that causes a mild flu-like illness in adults, but for women who are in their first trimester of pregnancy, it can be really problematic because it substantially increases the risk of microcephaly, children born with abnormally small heads and developmental disorders. It is traveled to from Africa in 2007. It made it into Polynesia and spread through there for a few years, then showed up in Brazil in May of last year. So again, identified in 1947, in Africa, not seen outside Africa in 2013. This is like chikungunya. The chikungunya virus, which is now spread and is pretty widespread throughout the Caribbean and South America and is making its way into the United States. There have been cases as far north as Kentucky and Indiana. But this Zika virus, mainly found South America and Africa and Polynesia right now. But it has become such a concern in South America and Central America that the government of El Salvador is actually telling women there, don't get pregnant until 2018. Don't get pregnant until we can wipe this out. Brazil is deploying genetically modified male mosquitoes. They've been genetically modified so that when they fertilize eggs, the eggs, about 95% of them will die to try to cut the mosquito population. But there is one site that's asking the question, because these modified mosquitoes were deployed in Brazil for the first time back in 2011, whether the genetically modified mosquitoes are actually making this virus more dangerous and perhaps spreading it more than they thought. Now, I haven't seen any good scientifically documented evidence that suggests that's the case, but the question has been asked. We'll keep an eye on this, because this is something that is going to become a concern as those mosquitoes spread northward, as they probably will. The Zika virus and the risk of microcephaly. The first case here in the United States actually found in Hawaii, a child born suffering from microcephaly just within the last week or two. So we'll be talking about this, I'm sure, on Sci Friday this coming week on SkyWatch TV. On SkyWatch TV Tuesday night, which airs on the Christian Television Network, 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. That's UTC-5 if you're outside the U.S. Dr. Michael Heiser is our guest. We got 2 weeks with Dr. Michael Heiser talking about his book, The Unseen Realm, and why understanding the divine counsel concept is important to a proper understanding of Scripture and the biblical narrative. The long war between God and the angels who rebelled for the human soul. Christian Television Network is available on satellite TV, Dish Network, channel 267, DirecTV, channel 376, also on the Glory Star satellite, channel 117, and their programming streams to the internet at ctnonline.com. So if you're overseas or you don't have satellite TV and you want to watch the program, just log in to ctnonline.com Tuesday night, 9:30 p.m. Eastern, 6:30 p.m. Pacific time in the U.S., and you'll be blessed. It was an awesome couple of discussions. We're very proud of those programs. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, got some interesting programs here. Dr. Timothy Furnish will rejoin us. He's just released another new book called Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate. You see what he did there? S-E-C-T-S, Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate. His other book, 10 Years Fascination with the Mahdi's Camps, is about radical Islamic eschatology. Sects, Lies, and the Caliphate deals more with Islamic history, which we in the West are generally pretty ignorant of. So that'll be the next program. It will probably go up on Thursday night rather than Wednesday. Next Sunday, Dr. Scott Lively. His ministry is focused on defending the family, the biblical definition of the family. He's being sued for crimes against humanity under international law, and an American court is allowing the case to proceed. So we got a couple of issues here. And you'll hear that next week, Sunday. February 3rd, Brian Godawa returns. He's got a new series he's just launched. Just finished reading the first book, The Dragon King. Fantastic novel. His collaborator on this, Charlie Wen, they've come up with a way to reinvigorate the series. They finished the Chronicles of the Nephilim series, Brian did. And now he's moved on to the Chronicles of the Watchers. And this is the first release available officially on February 1st. So we'll hold that interview until the 3rd. On the 7th of February, Eddie Donnelly, another new guest of View from the Bunker. He's got a novel out called Doctrines of Demons. And he's got an interesting story of his own. Really interesting life before he was saved. And then a guest that should have... Boy, she should have been on this program long before, especially with what she's been doing, the work that she's been doing, and the book that she released last summer. Sheila Zielinski and her book, Green Gospel, about the pagan roots of the environmental movement. Similar, and in fact, she draws upon this other book for reference, but similar to Mark Musser's book, Nazi Oaks, which she cited in some of her research. So looking forward to talking to Sheila Zielinski, and we may actually be able to get her down to the Ozarks for Skywatch TV. And then Timothy Alberino is going to be in town next week here in the Ozarks. So hopefully we can sneak him into the studio for a little bit to talk about what he's doing with Gen 6 Productions and his partner, Steve Quayle. So that's what's ahead. Of course, all subject to change. The Gilbert House Fellowship, we're continuing our schedule of releasing two new Bible studies each week, about an hour long each time, going through the Bible in chronological order, New Testament and Old Testament, and those are posted at gilberthouse.org. If you're listening to this program on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find us, we'd appreciate it if you'd give us a review and join us on Facebook. That's where we have all the discussions about the programs. Facebook page, very simple. It's facebook.com/view from, well, there's a link on the website, vftb.net, and give us a like over there. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme, Kevin MacLeod, incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.